Well, hey, everybody, and welcome. I hope you're all doing great. You know, this is our last seminar, and I mentioned about if you want to hang around a little bit after the top of the hour for discussion and questions that we don't get to. But let's begin. What kind of thoughts, questions? Do you have anything that you'd like to talk a little bit more about before we begin to talk about writing new stories and in coaching? Or clarifications from anything we've talked about before? Anyone want to just check in? Here's something. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, David. It's Shirley Leonard calling from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
Welcome. How are you, Julie?
I'm good. You know what? We've got plus 7 or something here. It's incredibly warm, so it's crazy.
You're
warm.
On the plus side. I mean, yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
okay.
it's we're getting rain. It's November, end of November. Yeah, it's
okay.
Serious. But David, I meant to write this to you, and I did not, so I apologize. And we can talk about this at the end if it's better placed there. Somehow I missed out of last week's seminar. At the very end of the writing of the binder, it says, "What is your yellow chalk circle?" And somehow I totally missed that in the seminar. So that was my query, and I apologize. I should have emailed that to you, but I can hang around at the end if it's better placed there.
Okay. Here's the study. And remember, I look for some of the simplest studies anywhere. This was a study that was done in London in a very busy area where the researcher put a wallet in the middle of a corner on a busy intersection. And before he walked away, he drew a yellow chalk circle around it and then videotaped everything that followed.
Mm.
What followed, as you might suspect, possibly, not a single person took that wallet, not a single person touched it, nobody took money from it, and they did the video for 2 hours, and no one touched the wallet. The yellow chalk circle was the constructed boundary as if it were the actual boundary for no one to touch it. So anyone could have walked up, taken the money. It was there. It wasn't anyone's wallet. It was just money that was there. So the question is we look at unconscious biases, blind spots, and other things that may be limiting assumptions. What's your yellow chalk circle first, you have to recognize what any kind of limitations may be. And we're going to talk some more about that this seminar, about writing new stories. You can't access and change what you don't see. So anything, you know, blind spots are by definition things you don't see. Inattention blindness, things you by definition don't pay attention to. Unconscious biases, well, they're unconscious. So this is some of the things that we do and that we listen for as mentor coaches with our clients as their stories unfold with us, and they will co-create with us, as we've talked before, the kinds of things that will show us exactly what it's like to be them and exactly what they need help with and collaboration to revise or construct a new story. So coaching is so much about the ways that a client will recreate the process to show us exactly what it's like to be them, what they need help with, and what they haven't been quite able to access themselves, because how can a fish describe water? It can't get outside the system to do it. So that's what some of what we've been doing is about, to look at creating new stories, and I want to bring some of that together in terms especially of updating an operating system in our discussion this evening. So, Julie, does that make sense to you?
Yes, thanks so much, David.
That was not a gotcha. That's a misprint somewhere, but I'm glad you brought it to the foreground so we could talk about it. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Great. So think about if any of you have a yellow chalk circle. You know, that may be something, if you consider it this way, we each have stories about what we have to do or what we have to have in place to take the next step, when all you have to do is take the next step. We can create contingencies to rationalize or position the initiation of a new or challenging action as if something needs to happen. Well, I need to really get certified before I start charging for professional coaching. Now, the contingency seems to make it make sense and understandable to postpone, but it's just another way of stopping. I'll need to take care of some correspondence before I can start doing marketing. I'll wait till I have time without interruption before starting my tax preparation. I need to get really organized before I start on my book. So, do you have any yellow chalk circle? Do you have any reasons to postpone eating healthier, exercising more, initiating a newer challenging task? Remember, a basic component of deliberate practice to move to peak performance is that you have in place a system, a plan, that you stick to it. And every aspect of practice is doing just a little bit more than before, meaning that you're always in the experience of being slightly uncomfortable because you're moving just beyond your comfort zone. If you didn't move beyond your comfort zone, you'd be doing the same thing. In a classic study of various performers, the performers who peaked kept doing the same thing. They practiced the things they did really well. The peak performers and the elite performers did deliberate practice to each time have a specific system and a way of moving at least a step into what they're needing and doing that's uncomfortable. So think about that next time when you do something or need to do something that doesn't quite feel comfortable. There are going to be any number of reasons to find to not do it. And this is exactly how our brains work. We find a reason to make it make sense to stop, and that ends any dissonance, any anxiety, any uncertainty. But if we keep it open, then we keep an acquisitional mind, a mind of exploration, of looking at possibilities. And that's exactly what we do in coaching. That's the interface of now and next that we engage with every client in coaching. Now, does anybody else dare to ask a question or clarify or make a comment after that? Any other thoughts or things that you want to comment on? If you would like to think of something or add to what you sent in for the initial questions, and I'm going to ask you at the end, and I have the list of things that you would like to get out of this collaboration together, these seminars, what's the most pressing question you have, not in that order, and I'm hoping to have answered them, but I'd like to hear from you. What's the one thing you're taking away that seems most important right now from this series? I'm going to bring that up at the end because I'm eager to hear, and I'm eager to hear if it fits with what you thought initially would be the most important thing to take away from this series. Okay, so I'm going to put us on a lecture mode. I'm going to reserve some time at the end and then some additional time at the top of the hour. So jot down anything you'd like to come back to or just discuss. Okay, we're going to talk about updating your operating system, about specifically writing new stories, the very thing that we do with each of our clients. Now, first, the brain story of self is something to consider. There's a very specific area in the brain that the sense of self resides in. It's the medial prefrontal cortex. This is the on brain imaging studies, the part of the brain that activates when we're looking at and understanding and developing something in terms of our sense of self, which is basically our identity. This part of the brain lights up when people self-reflect, when they make assessments and judgments regarding themselves. So here are some self-reflection prompts that I'll bet you engage in without even calling them that or conceptualizing them in that way. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. This is more than what you want to get done this week, what you want to plan, structure, create a system for, but what's the story from your sense of self? Are you listening to it? Tell your story in a way that you want it to be to actualize it. Your story, like a good book, a business plan, needs a plan, a map, and then an initiation of the creation of it. Think about how we talked about, and this is redundant from many other sources, I'm sure, we talked about each coaching session creating a map to look at what the client wants to focus on, where the client wants to get to, and then you creatively collaborate to manifest that for the client, a beginning, middle, and end, like any story, the challenge, the development, and the resolution. So this is what it may be helpful for you to think about for yourself as a story. What's your story? What are the components of that story? What's your money story? What's your wellness story? What's your relationship story? What's your business or professional story? Where are you with each of these storylines? And those are only a few. And whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is a response to the story you're telling yourself. Remember, we talked about it in kind of a reverse way earlier, that the reason you don't get what you want may be the story that you're telling yourself about why you can't have it. So if you want to change, if you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell that story so that it shifts your thinking, your feeling, your experience, and your frame It's about possibility. Remember the two ape colonies and the anthropologist. Two very different stories, all unfolded in every aspect over that year with the basic belief of each of the two anthropologists being very different. Now, this new telling has to align with who you are, especially your needs and ideals, in order to have a complete energy field and a full purposeful direction of that field going forward, so that your needs and ideals, in other words, align with your strategies and goals, so that all of you is going in the same direction. That's what you want to know at the beginning of each coaching engagement with a new client, to know their ideals and needs so that you can develop a strategy and goals from the client's perspective that will be collaboratively, successively approximating those objectives for the client. When you practice your authentic story, it activates your full energy and power. All of you goes in the same direction. When that occurs, simply know the direction you're going, the goals and strategies, so that all of it's aligned. So often, when I work with someone in mentor coaching, the first session, I want to understand clearly their needs and ideals and what their story wants to be, what they want their story to be, their objective, so that we create a map from the beginning. Now, we can talk a little bit more about that at a later point if you like. And know that you can keep telling and living a better story no matter how good your story is now. The universe will resonate with and match your story as you live it. So I want to talk about a couple of things that we sometimes get to the cusp of but may not talk about so directly in coaching. One is pre-commitment. Not just commitment, but pre-commitment. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men are sailing home from the Trojan War. He'd been warned about the sirens. Their seductive song led sailors to destruction, but he wanted to hear it anyhow. So he does two things. Gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore his pleas for release until their safety past danger. Now, his management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against his predictable and potentially fatal future desire. Remember, we've talked about from cigarettes to Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries in this same, this is just a way of conceptualizing this, because willpower alone may not have been sufficient, and Odysseus knew no one's immune to temptation. So pre-commitment can be especially useful when it comes to bad habits or obvious weaknesses. Pre-commitment involves present planning and action against the strength of future desires, either by taking certain options off the table, making them prohibitively costly, or just simply unavailable. Pre-commitment works and enables someone to control actions by not controlling actions, but simply not engaging them. So let's extend that a little bit to look at commitment devices. Now, as we think about being an accountability partner in coaching, commitment devices may be a consideration. There have been studies on how people self-impose as well as co-create commitments for behaviors that they know are in their best interest. Think about how we help our kids do this. A piggy bank is a commitment device to counter impulsive purchases. You can't get at it. Some alcoholics take Antabuse, a pill that makes you sick if you drink. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for three papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at the chance. Now think about that for a minute. 100% of every student everywhere has the option to create their own earlier deadline for a paper rather than just fitting in to the protocol of what the professor says about when it's due. 100%. That's moving the point of reference to the individual to create their own story. P. people find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. A study at Harvard Business School looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing the things they wanted and the things that they should have, wants and needs. Some devised ways to put off either purchasing or having delivered the things they wanted to ensure that they would do what they should do first, what they needed to do. So they made it a contingency. Here's a goofy suggestion I heard from someone who sent me a note after reading The Secret Language of Money. She said, well, you know, I froze a credit card in ice, and that made me really contemplate before any purchase. Well, for her, that worked. Or think about a very different way of doing it. If you want to save for retirement, all you need to make is one good decision. One time, you make a decision to have the amount of money you decide each month automatically transferred from checking to retirement. One decision. You don't have to revisit. You don't have to make it every time. You make a one-time decision, and it can make a difference for the rest of your life. So let's think about practical ways. Now, we've talked about minds and brain sciences, but let's talk about really simple practical ways of engineering effectiveness. How many of you have dealt with clients where there are negative thought loops, negative self-talk? When someone gets triggered in a certain way, and it's almost always the result of a state change. Now, one way of dealing with this is to address the state change, to get grounded and centered, looking at the emotional trigger. Another way is simply for repetitive negative thoughts or negative self-talk or even things that you repeat to yourself that you know come from an earlier time. But your brain, if you think about it, those negative self-talk statements, those negative thought loops, those are not new. They come from a time capsule. Those are the same things you said to yourself maybe at 5, at 13, 14 years ago, in some form or another. So how do you deal with them right now? Mostly right now, how do you help a client? Well, there is a very specific way that's been very studied and is very replicable, is self-directed neuroplasticity. There are only three steps, and I've done this very recently with a client. It was immensely effective for him. As soon as you recognize your brain is automatically repeating something that you've done scores and maybe even hundreds of times before, recognize immediately that it's a repetition. It's not an assessment of a situation. It's not an accurate plan. It's simply a repetition. It's a negative self-talk. Recognize it as quickly as possible to label it as an error message from your brain, because your brain is simply doing what it's been hardwired to do, and that's to repeat the familiar. So if it's a repetition of the familiar to say, I just don't think I can do this right, recognize that as an error message from your brain in order to reframe what that message is about, to look at the possibility, at the challenge, not the problem, not the dead end, not the all the negative things that are associated with that, but error message from the brain, refocus on what's the challenge right now, what's the next best thing, to refocus. That's the third step. Recognize, reframe, and refocus to the next step. That's all you have to do. Three steps. And the sooner you recognize it as an error message from your brain, you stop it. Then you reframe to look at possibility, at challenge, at what will further your best efforts, and then refocus on this specific step of doing it. And this fits with what Jung talked about. Some problems you can't outlive, some problems you can't solve, rather. You just have to outlive. This is a way of outliving negative self-talk. By definition, that time capsule is going to preserve every one of those comments. Every time you go back to them, it etches the pathway even further and more deeply. So it's about creating a new pathway. It won't be easy the first time, but when you repeat it, it ultimately will rewire your brain. So here are some essentials of engineering effective change based on this neural rewiring. Focus specifically on the next step. Here's a basic story about that. Some of you have heard me tell this before. Terry Fox ran the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed, though, to average 24 miles a day and completed the run in 143 days. When he finished the race, exhausted, he was interviewed and asked, how did he keep going when he knew he had thousands of miles ahead? He said, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. Now, he knew where he wanted to go. He had a goal, but he focused specifically on the next step and kept doing that for 3,339 miles, and that's a bunch of telephone poles. Two, specify the next step. It's not abstract, not global. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. Specify the next step so you'll know when you get there, so you'll know when you've done it. Three, make changes tangible and concrete. This is what we do in constructing a map. We can measure progress along the way to know where we are, know where we're going. Measure progress along the way, and that helps you know what's detour and distraction. And again, that's the beauty of a map, all the stuff you don't focus on. And the power of attention to a focus, all the millions of possible stimuli are irrelevant because you have one focus. You've aligned the energy field of the brain to one thing. Make progress measurable. A specific destination. A tangible focus on the next step. Make progress visible as well. Small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible. Now, this is something that we probably naturally do, but I want to highlight it here because when you do this process with a client and look together at resonating with their experience of effectiveness or mastery at a step, you're helping them internalize a model, not just of self-reflection, but of self-validation, so that when they create and bring about an experience of effectiveness and mastery, they self-validate. That means at some point in the future, the work is legacy. They've internalized that model, and they don't need you anymore, but that's the objective. That's the end in mind in the beginning, so that a client doesn't need us anymore because they've internalized the process. So make sure it's an excellent process that really develops self-awareness, self-reflection, and a model of how to create a system to go about creating what they want. So what we've just done is adopt the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. And the scientific method is a challenge to create a mindset of inquiry and the discomfort of going just beyond a comfort zone. And that's what catalyzes growth. So let's talk a little bit about choice enhancement. The kinds of considerations to apply to choices and emotions accompanying those choices. Just some things to know about how the mind and brain work. You guys know this already, but I want to reiterate it. Increased T tension produces emotional regression. With increased tension or conflict, the stress response reaction can move somebody to an emotional pattern that sometimes leaves logic and abandons reason, or is characteristic of an earlier age. So what we want to do is help a client develop ways to recognize this, to find a way for each specific client to get grounded and centered and be able to use this self-reflective capacity. Now, increased emotion also narrows perspective at the same time. When emotion prevails, focus can become narrower and more restricted to the most recent event. Now, paradoxically, it seems, with someone who is more escalated emotionally, attempting to use reason and logic actually deepens that pattern of getting stuck in the escalating emotion. Their right brain gets more and more successful at seizing and holding hostage their left brain. So if you try to use reason and logic, the escalated individual will further escalate, dig in their toes, spiral into more extreme responses, and hurl themselves away from logic. Usually this is something we see that gets reported to us so that we can reflect with the client about the process of getting grounded and centered, of using their own resources, whether that's mindfulness, meditation, progressive relaxation, or simply developing a mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology we talked about, to instantly get grounded and centered. So, in other words, when someone's in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings. And sometimes that simply is to have us respond empathically to resonate with the client's experience, whether that's upset or overwhelm, before we begin to move to looking at strategy and story. Remember, state always comes first, then strategy and story, because when someone's in a regulated state, they have access to all of their states of mind and all of the balance of emotional and intellectual. It may be helpful to look at use of energy. This is probably more so, or most so, with people who have attention challenges, to be able to create and sustain a focus, create a framework, a fence around their performance and their engagement, their immersion, and create that framework to do everything possible to enhance what they do. And we talked about that in one of the case illustrations. And part of that is finding an optimum state of mind for a particular task. And then to protect that time, that state of mind, to be able to enter and exit a state of mind at will and fitting the specific task. So what we talk about doing, and what I've mentioned more than once, I know, is about how we work with a client in choice architecture, how we're looking at the present moment of how to create an optimum choice for the next step. Now, how we frame that's important. Remember, we already talked about how when our brains cannot determine the difference between anxiety and excitement, how a framework will help someone frame the process of what they engage next. If we label it as excitement, as challenge, we begin to look at creative new ways. If we label it as anxiety, we often frame that as a problem, go down the problem network already there in the brain, already etched, and look at trying to find a better solution. Guess what's going to work? So an example of choice architecture and how framing can make a difference. This is a simple and a goofy example, but it also emphasizes framing. Study at a local car wash that ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Every time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card. And when they filled up their card with 8 stamps, they got a free car wash. Now, another group, a matched group, as much as you can match people, I guess, at a car wash. I'm not sure about this deal. Got a loyalty card where it took 10 stamps to get a free car wash, but 2 were already filled in. They had already been added. So the goal was the same. Both groups took 8 new car washes to get a free card. But the psychology and the motivation was different. Those who had a head start with 2 stamps were already 20% of the way toward a goal. So several months later, they tallied the results. 19% of the 8 stamp customers earned a free car wash. 34% of the Head Start group earned a free car wash. They were more motivated because they saw themselves further along. And this is something I was just talking with a professional colleague about this because I heard him do it and I wanted to highlight it. When he emphasized just a very brief period of time remaining or just a few steps remaining, I asked him if he was aware of the studies that showed exactly what he was doing. There are studies that show that when someone gets closer to their destination, to the finish line, in essence, they get more motivated, more energized, and perform better. So this is why one of the things we do in helping a client internalize the process is to reflect on where they are at this point, to acknowledge their step or steps, perhaps even at times to reflect on how far they've come or get them to. And this process of having them observe that they're making strides, that they're seeing in this map that we've co-created, they're seeing progress, they're seeing steps ahead, and that's self-validation. That's what they will do after the work with you has been internalized and metabolized, and they now take credit for it, which they deserve because it's their creation. So even the way you frame a question makes a difference. And here's an example of that. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings, the employee has to opt out to not participate, to make a choice that says, I will not save for the future. So instead of 100%, by the time they opt out, it levels off to the high 80%. Now, at companies where it isn't automatic and someone has to choose to opt in, just under 20% participate, a fourfold difference. So think about how important it is the way we frame something. We've talked about this before in the simplest of examples. When you give someone information, facts, data, instruction, directives, orders, they listen, but they also are seeing if it fits with what they believe. If they see it fitting, they're going to confirm. If they don't, they're going to refute it. So we engage a client by a question. That means the client is not taking in or rejecting information. We've created a partnership because a question introduces the possibility for participation. There's nothing to argue with or oppose or to counter. And think about this with your teenage kids or grandkids. When you ask a question, you engage somebody. So you have a partnership in its beginning phases. You have a collaboration, and that's the essence of the framework of our work with clients. So we help clients reframe. Somebody has a setback, a disappointment, a crisis. Rather than continue on the upsetting issue and the negative energy or looking at the problem or the cause, what's the opportunity here? And when someone seems right, what else do you think of? So this is the way we begin to think about how we can help someone reframe and refocus. Remember the second and third steps of self-directed neuroplasticity: recognize, reframe, refocus. And focus where you have direct impact, what you can determine, where you can be effective. This is your circle of influence. So this is what you may want to look at with a client when they're engaging something they can't be effective in doing, to refocus on what they can be effective in doing. We'll return to that in a discussion if any of you are interested, even in just a bit, more of some comments about the reframing that we do, because a framework determines the meaning that we attach to something. Remember, I asked the question, gave the statement, don't think about an elephant. What are you thinking about right now? This was the title of a book by a very well-known social psychologist, Dr. George Lakoff, to talk about how framing determines everything we do. And he's applied it particularly to politics, but I think even more so, it applies to what we do each conversation with a client. Because what we focus on, we bring about. So we want to be sure it's a positive, engaging focus, not just avoiding something that we don't want. So these are the things that I think can be useful as we talk about how do we engage clients in the most meaningful way. How does what we do fit with mind, brain, and performance sciences? Now, another thing, let's return for just a minute to the dopamine response, the reward center of the brain. When brain activity is monitored during performance, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, lights up whenever we anticipate a pleasure, a gain of money, of something that we want. And this anticipation can create its own reward. Now, neuroscientists have found a paradox from the brain in this. And when I presented this information as part of a keynote to 600 members of a consortium of nonprofit foundation, I saw a lot of raised eyebrows and open mouths. The paradox is one that is inversely related to the pleasure center, that part of the brain that mediates social interactions about how we perceive and relate to others. And this is the posterior superior temporal sulcus, for the couple of you who didn't want to know that. This part of the brain, the altruism center, lights up when we help others and form bonds. So the pleasure center and the altruism center are directly opposite each other. They're antagonists. So that's the paradox. The pleasure center and the altruism center compete with one another. When one's in control, the other shuts off. So when someone does something like nonprofit charity work for altruistic reasons, that altruism center is firing. If money's offered, the altruism center shuts down and the pleasure center lights up. So you can't have it both ways, which seems like a paradox. Here are a couple of examples. One large blood center, low on supplies for transfusions, decided to pay people to donate blood. Offering to pay decreased the number of donors by almost 50%. What they found that reversed the effect? Letting the donors contribute that payment to charity. Here's another example. When daycare centers in Israel began fining parents for late pickups, which they thought would certainly motivate parents to come and get their kids on time and avoid paying more money. Well, the number of tardy parents more than doubled. Why? Well, the parents felt they weren't ethically obligated to not inconvenience the teacher because they felt, well, they're paying for it now. They're paying for their lateness. Time, in other words, became a commodity. Studies repeatedly show that a financial reward will undermine altruistic motivation. When the pleasure center hijacks the altruism center, motivation changes dramatically to that of self-interest. Now, here's a summary of listening as mentor coaches. As mentor coaches, we become accustomed to listening to a story without trying to fix it. So, here are some principles, and we can review any of these. First, put your ego in a blind trust. In other words, don't take it personally. Be especially aware if there are issues that are sensitive or triggering to you from what the client says, to be very aware of staying centered yourself and focused on the client. We have enough of a challenge already with all of the things that are unconscious bias and leanings, which we would consciously disavow, that may have to do with gender, with age, with race, with socioeconomic, with any number of things that we would consciously disavow, but yet unconsciously have connections that we sometimes operate on, or at least can exert subtle influences. We can talk about that at a discussion time if you're interested. Second, listen to the language of a client, whether it's passive or active. If a client moves suddenly to passive action, then that to me is a coachable moment, because I want the client to actively speak of what they're going to do, not as if they're the recipient of action happening to them. Listen to the point of reference, whether it's internal or external, whether someone is reacting to others or initiating that action, creating their own story in each of the storylines. Listen to the source of authority, whether it's self or others. Well, there's nothing I can do. That's passive and deferring as if someone else is the authority to determine what to do. Listen for the initiation of action, whether it's proactive or reactive. Listen for how centered the speaker is in his or her experience. So you may want to pause to reflect on this about getting grounded and centered, or just asking, how grounded and centered do you feel right now? Listen for the state of mind of the speaker, whether the state of mind is regulated and fits the task. Remember, state always before strategy and story. And listen for self-reference in the first or second person. Listen to any interview after or during, I'm thinking of some of the political ones right now, during a challenging time. Usually when we talk, we speak in first person, I or we. And that means we're centered in our own experience. We are initiating the action. If you suddenly hear your client switch to you when they're referring to themselves, it may be that there's something that they're uncomfortable or wanting to distance or disavow at that moment. And the times, and I don't do this every time, but I come close. When I've observed that, because remember, I have asked for and received permission from my clients to be able to interrupt at any time. This may be one of those times. Now, let's look at how you move from speaking from your own experience, saying I, to then move to say you as if you were observing yourself. Then the client may recognize that there's something that's uncomfortable. they wanted to disavow that aspect of what they did, or it's just something they wanted to move from the playing field to the observer's platform to get some kind of distance. That itself can be helpful. Now, you have to have a good working alliance with somebody first to really take them up on their permission to interrupt, but also to engage this in a meaningful way to be sure. What we want to do in this collaborative model is to be absolutely certain that a client does not, that we offer it in a way that it's not critical, pejorative, or judgmental in any way so that we maintain that collaborative alliance. So here are some elements of successful changes that we do in mentor coaching. This is a summary, really, of what we've talked about. So we focus on solutions rather than understanding why. Not about giving opinions or advice or dictates, but since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to really change a story from the inside out. The first requirement is someone recognizing and taking ownership of their story in order to really assess and map the changes that they want. Then, to create a plan to author those changes and to program new identity. Those are the seven steps, the algorithm of the roadmap process that you've seen and that we've talked about. So, let's review some important elements that we do in helping someone bring about change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't solve it. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps. Regulate a state of mind to manage emotions and to promote full engagement, mind, brain, spirit, body. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. People can usually tell the difference between inquiries to prompt insight versus attempts at persuasion or camouflaging an opinion in the form of a question of, hey, have you thought about what? Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. Remember, the power is in the focus, always. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model that the client is developing in order to facilitate yet another level of mastery. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy to the new idea, to the challenge, to the possibility. That's what creates new neural networks and pathways in a beginning way. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Through insight and engagement, it changes the mind and brain. And again, conceptualize the meta map with a client in order to master and internalize this process. This can help create a way, an additional level of mastery to incorporate the new experiences into the client's story as part of an evolving identity. And remember, again, the most powerful thing in the human psyche is our sense of identity, because we'll always come back to it. So if any behavior, any change is not incorporated as part of who you are and how you are of this new model, you'll revert back to the old behavior. So, one of the things, as we close, here are a couple of my predictions, since you ask. Going forward, we will develop ways of recognizing and understanding synchronicities, individual and collective energy fields, and a number of phenomena which are part of our experience and universe that the tomorrows ahead will evolve in new concepts and descriptive systems. We'll develop words in a language, a nomenclature for things we can only sense right now. For example, individual and collective energy fields and how this stems from Einstein's unified field theory of human energy. The magician, Harry Houdini, reminded us, just because something's unexplained doesn't mean it's supernatural. And, to paraphrase another excellent author, in addition to Harry, Garrison Keillor, be well, be happy, and go out and do good works. So it's been my pleasure and my privilege to discuss these notions with you in these four seminars. I hope we'll have additional opportunity to collaborate, but I'm very grateful for this right now. And hold on if you'd like to have discussion, questions, thoughts, want to add something, ask something, let me get us into discussion mode. Okay, what you got? What would be helpful to talk about? Or first, let me ask you, what is the most important thing for you, just in a very succinct phrase or sentence, that you're taking away? And how does it fit with what you wanted 4 weeks ago?
Hi, this is Danny McDoney, David,
hey.
And hello to everybody.
How are you?
Well, great. What a wonderful four sessions. For me, the synchronicity, the experience and developing the individual per se, that for me has been not only a great experience for coaching, but also for my inner journey, which I've enjoyed very much. So learning about that has been a big balcony that has been opened in my life. So thank you for opening that, David.
Thank you, Danny. That was a great summary. I appreciate that. Super. Who else?
I have a question, Matt.
Yeah, this is...
My name is Alexander Crook. I'm from San Francisco.
Welcome. Hey, great to have you. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. So the question is, well, I think that we know all the answers. And the question is, why do we know all the answers?
Are you talking about you and each client you have knows all the answers?
Well, every human in general has all the answers, but we just don't see them. We just don't want to accept them.
You're saying the answers are there to be...
Any answers we have, any problem, we know the answer, we just don't want to accept it for some reason. Or we don't see the answers. But
okay.
I think they are always there. And why they are there?
Well, I think that's really an excellent observation, that at one level, we see the answers that we believe so that we're always right, but sometimes the repetition of that and not seeing other possibilities but having the confirmation bias of seeking what we want to see and giving inattention or disregard to anything that doesn't fit our belief confirms and is validating and feels good for a moment because it confirms our identity. Because remember, at a brain level, a belief as well as an identity, a fact and information, they're anatomical realities in our brain. So we're seeking to confirm and validate because that's a way of feeling effective. But then we have to look in a bigger perspective to see, is this really working or is there a better way? That's what every deliberate practice episode for elite performers ask. What's a better way? Is there how can I improve? So we need to look beyond what we believe to see, in another sense, what's working and what's not working. If we simply confirm what we believe, we're stuck. We're looking at and validating the same thing again and again. We're like the athlete who practices what they're good at each time because it feels good, but, oh, yeah, by the way, they're getting beat because the opponent has figured out what they've been practicing on, and they put the ball on every other part of the court than that one sweet spot where they have a great forehand. When I was taking lessons to try to stay up with my wife who was competing in racquetball, my coach said, okay, Dave, here's what you're doing. You're getting set up and getting, you know, body position, your backhand, to say, well, here's a good place that I'd like to hit this forehand. I sure hope the ball comes here. I knew what I knew, but somehow it didn't fit. So I had to change my game plan. I mean, he was teasing, but not totally. So we know what we know because we validate it again and again. That's what we do in coaching. If what people know worked, we'd be out of business. So the idea is we have to help someone come to know what they know and begin with that to then go someplace new together. Remember the thing I think I mentioned early on, the best supervision I ever had was back in the day when I did psychoanalysis, a woman executive, when I offered an interpretation that I thought would be particularly useful, she paused and said, no, Kruger, first you have to start where I am and go someplace new. And she was totally right. We have to begin with where the client is. We can't ask the client to begin with what we know is the truth. It won't happen. They'll disengage, and they'll find ways to either refute it or validate it, and it will look like engagement, but it's not really for what we do in coaching. So that's why the Collaborative Alliance is so useful, beginning with the client as point of reference, not our story. But we begin with their story. They tell us their story, and then we can look together at what's working and what's not working so they can begin to get curious as we are about how they make these choices without even being consciously aware of them, yet they're not working. So really a good point. Does that, Alexander, does that address what you're saying at all?
Yeah, overall, yes. But
is there another part to it that would help to clarify that you can be specific about?
No, actually, I don't know if it's possible, but I would like to talk to you a little bit more, and I'm not very well in English, so I don't want to take time here right now.
English is my second language. Texan is my first, and you're doing just as good in English as I am, so keep going.
Sort of did not expect that, so not prepared, but if somebody has a question, they can go ahead.
Well, come
maybe
back if you want to, you know, think about what you want to toss out.
Yes.
Okay, super. Thank and thank you. That was great. Well, who else? What else?
Hi, Dave. It's Carlene.
Hey, welcome, Carlene. How are you?
I'm really good, thanks.
Super.
I was fascinated by this inverse relationship between the altruism center and the pleasure center and how it relates to money. If you can just say a few more words about that, I'd be grateful for that.
Okay, the examples I gave were the most simple and specific example. Is there a question about that that would be helpful in terms of an application to coaching that you have?
Yeah, I think it just may be a little bit too complex for the time we have. But can you just recap the area of the brain
Well, practically speaking, the pleasure center is a specific area of the brain. The altruism center is another different area of the brain, but the two are antagonistic. They are competitive with each other, and they're connected enough that when one turns on, it turns off the other. So basically, we have to think about that in terms of certain applications, and this is more like in the illustrations that I gave. But the pleasure is about the anticipation of something, and that's what we know in coaching can create someone doing something that they can then be disappointed when they actually do it and have like buyer's remorse and that sort of thing, because it moves from the sprint system of anticipation to the marathon system of doing things over the long term that are hard work and require consistency and continuity. So that's how when someone may want to replicate the pleasure of something, like anticipating purchasing something, that when they purchase it, they'll want another hit. So when someone is buying something, there's a greater chance that they're going to sustain that and buy and spend more. So that's where we may want to help someone listen to a plan and a structure. Do they have a plan? Do they have a time, a budget, or whatever? Because someone can get lost in the moments of the pleasure and of continuing that. And that can apply in a number of instances. So these are just some of the things that we may listen for, that in knowing some aspects of how the brain works, it may inform some of how we listen to a client and resonate with their experience to help them understand creating a system rather than creating a flow into what feels good and trying to sustain that. You know, something that I'm working on right now, kind of an illustration of this, is how someone has difficulty with extreme success because it brings the need to deal with things in a very different way than anything they've ever planned or ever experienced. And all the results of extreme success, like fame and money, can create all kinds of responses that can keep, that can get someone off a trajectory or out of a game plan. And especially when it's something that people have not had the experience and do not have a model of how to operate. Consider the pro athlete who went from a background of having nothing to do with fame, wealth, and goes from 0 to 60 million in one signature, suddenly has to deal with things in different ways. I'll bet each of you have or will experience this with clients. I don't think we have a model as yet. Let me ask if you'd manage the background, because anything you do, is your microphone is picking it up. So if you'd mute until you're ready to talk. A way of dealing with regulating the extreme success and creating plans and ways of proceeding for those who experience that. So that's just one example of that. So hopefully, Carlene, I sort of did some response that was helpful for that question. Thank you for asking. Anyone else, what is the main thing you're taking away, and how does it fit with what you imagined you wanted to take away 4 weeks ago?
Hi, David, and everyone. This is Kiera from Georgia.
Welcome. Hey.
The state. So when you spoke about the mind maps, that really resonated with me, because realize with clients and even myself about how important it is to create a map. I think prior, you know, you think about chronological processes, but the way that you described it gave me, you know, a new insight. And that's when I started, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to help, you know, people shift their mindset to align with their desires and gain more knowledge about the brain function and how to, you know, make those decisions. So that was a way that you helped me come to that. So I want to dive more into that.
Great. And that's great. I think it's if you want to explore more as a result of this, then my job is done. I'm very glad to hear that, and I think it's useful. You know, I think to continue to explore the things that can be useful, create passions, fit with our ideals, and can benefit others, that's huge. So
yeah,
thanks
so
for
thank
that.
You. No,
great.
Thank you.
Super. Who else? What are you taking away? Just in a very brief, succinct overview.
David, it's Shirley.
I'm sorry, this is
Shirley
who? This is who?
Shirley in, Shirley in Edmonton.
Well,
hi.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. Just because I know other people will probably want to join in, I just wanted to say I was particularly feeling that I just needed refresher. I needed new knowledge. I needed a shot in the arm. It's been a couple of hard years. And so it was really, how can I become a better coach? And I've seen your seminars advertised and always said, yes, I'm going to do one and never do it. But so there was a lot of motivation there for me to just do better at what it is that I really do love to do. And one of the things I'm taking away is just how little I know. And so I just want to say thank you for that, because I have so much curiosity around so much of what has been covered in each of the sessions. And so, yeah, I'm on a new quest to do some more exploration. Absolutely. So thank you so much.
Super. Thank you very much. That's that's admirable. Who else? A main thing that you're taking away. One thing I wanted to add to the comment about I know what I know, and I know what there is to know. What do you do with that as a coach? You know, you won't get very far, or you won't get someone to pay your monthly retainer if you say, no, you don't. Let me show you. One question may be, what evidence would you need to change your mind about that? And at least it would engage someone to think alongside their conviction, if not maybe from a little bit of a different way. It took us as humans 100,000 years to invent the scientific method. And before that, we lived our lives by stories, by examples, and by the urgent, and we still do. So an anecdote is not evidence, but we often treat it that way. So an honest answer to the question, what evidence would you need, probably would be something like, I need a new story that's more immediate, more vivid, and most of all, more aligned with me than the one I have right now. But I don't quite know how to get the perspective to do that. Remember, someone begins with where they are. That includes their identity. And their story is not a story. It's just the way things are. So you can't begin by challenging their story, because you're challenging their identity. I'd fire you myself if you did that. So think about the question of how do you engage someone, often by a question. Other thoughts about what you're taking away or anything else? We've got just a couple of minutes about what you'd like to touch on or talk about or just add at this point.
This is Kip.
Hey, Kip, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing just great. You mentioned the unified field. Could you say a little bit more about the nature of the unified field or the quantum field, and how can we most efficiently access it?
Okay. Great questions. Einstein talked about the unified field theory of energy. Basically, his theory was that we are each a bundle of energy, and we interact with another person who is a bundle of energy, and we create a third entity, that shared energy field. And the same with groups of people, that each group we interact with, we're interacting with the collective field of that group. Let me give you two quick examples. One is, I think, a natural experiment. The NBA, 84 games, 42 away, 42 at home. Every team loses more games away and wins more at home. They have a collective energy field, in the old days at least, of 75, 85,000 people, most of whom, many of whom, at away games are sending negative energy to the visitors. They lose more games. The reverse happens at home. Let me give you an example, and I don't think you were not there. Let me give you an example. The last presentation I did was the most risky for me before COVID. It was to a group of cybersecurity chiefs for Fortune 100 companies, and we were talking about this in terms of. It seemed appropriate at the time, anyhow. So I asked for, trust me on that, I don't have a chance to build up the story to make it believable or salvageable. I asked for a volunteer to come forward to help me illustrate the contagion of states of mind and energy field with the group. And volunteer came up, and I asked him to face the audience. And I stood behind him and asked him to extend his left arm. And I put my hand on his arm and asked him to resist me pushing his arm down as hard as he could. So with my left hand, with some force, I could push his arm down. Now, I ask every person in the group to send him positive energy in any way to them that meant positive energy. I asked him again to extend his left arm, tried to push it down, and could not. With all of my strength and my left, I could not push his arm down. Now, I asked him and the group to wipe the slate clean, and for just a moment, to send him negative energy, negative thoughts. And again, extended his arm. I could push it down with one index finger. The collective energy field has a powerful force. And think about how the applications can be for that. And I'll leave you with that because there are many. So does that make sense to you about, and this is how contagious states of mind are, faster than the fastest virus, and why I emphasize that confidence is a state of mind. Get in a state of being totally present, totally confident, as you begin to receive a call, when you receive a call from a client, so that you can focus totally and exclusively on that client and be totally attuned to what they say and all of the intuitive capacity that you have when you're fully immersed in that process. Because it can happen just as well on a telephone, I would say a bit better at times, than it can in person or by video conference. Kip, does that answer your question, at least in the beginning way?
Yes, it does. And if you have any suggestions on how I can get my left arm down now, I'd appreciate
it. Okay. All right. Well, I know we're out of time, even beyond what I had mentioned. Thank you all for all of your responses, all the emails, the responses to my questions, and all of your energy for this engagement that we've had. I hope it's been useful, and I'll be eager to hear from you. If I can be of help to you, let me know, but I'm interested in applications and further thoughts at any point. And I hope we're not done. Thanks very, very much. I appreciate this, and I'm very honored and privileged that you guys have done this with me. Thanks. Bye now.
Thank you.
Have a great holiday season. See you.
You too.
Thanks.
Thank you.